So first let me say thank you for accommodating all this craziness. I'm sure they explained why we're doing this. And if my allergy weren't so extreme, we certainly wouldn't have done this. But it's really generous of you all to do this dance so that we could do this class.
Indeed.
I beg your pardon?
Indeed.
Oh, good. But really, how interesting that now it involves the board as well. So we've got the whole mishpacha, everybody's here. Okay, just had a question. How many of you have actually been able to read this last chapter? Okay. All right. This material in particular this whole module has been challenging, and this material is difficult to digest without having without bringing you back to meditation practice. And so it's difficult for even people who've been meditating for a long time. And I think, as Michael said, he goes, you go back over and over this material again and again, and you see something new in it. You understand something that you didn't understand before. Why? Because you've put meditation practice and your own experience together, so that all of a sudden something clicks and something makes sense. Meditation creates the space to actually see clearly, to see the present moment clearly, and to be able to observe the workings of our own mind. So it's a very intimate process. Your experience will be different from your experience and from mine. And what we're seeing and integrating and acknowledging, this becomes our path. So it's never a matter of believing any of this material. Like, this is something you have to believe. It's actually, you have, by meditating, we have the opportunity to observe ourselves as we are perceiving our situations, as we're making assumptions, as we're solidifying, as we're clinging to our points of view, as we're acting on our grasping and our rejecting and our ignoring fundamentally all the time. So it's not just you. What's the great phrase? We're all bozos on this bus. this is just a little pep talk, and going back a little bit to the previous chapter on meditation before we go into tonight's subject, which is auspicious coincidence. So again, working with our mind during meditation practice is actually training our mind to recognize and disown our thoughts while we're on the cushion. Essentially, trap your body. You're really, literally not doing anything. And therefore, you get to see your mind in all its flaming glory, running around, doing anything you possibly can, not to actually experience just this. And through this meditation practice of recognizing and disowning, we actually begin to instill an allegiance to space. And it creates the possibility of experiencing awareness and a more panoramic awareness during our everyday life. So one of the issues that was that we've talked about is actually what is meant by space. Does anybody have a sense of that space, what we're talking about?
The gap.
Sure. It's certainly that. And it can also be more in your everyday experience. So sort of the establishment of if your behavior, if you're learning how to behave, and it's not based on grasping or rejecting or doing whatever you can to establish your ego, to reinforce your ego, then all of a sudden you can actually literally experience space between you and what's going on around you. So you're not filling every moment with an opinion or an activity or a judgment, or you're not referring everything back to yourself. It's like, actually, things can happen that don't have anything to do with you. And that's back, can you believe it? And that don't need your opinion.
I don't think
so. And we don't have to protect ourselves. We don't have to arm ourselves. And you end up sort of developing a more of a sense of sharpness and precision. You can actually start seeing your world as more of a display. And you can actually start seeing people around you doing their thing. And you don't have to buy into it. And you, yes?
That's the best way I have fun. I teach a student who I think has a lot of stuff going on. And the other day, he dropped his pencil and said, "Now I can't do my work. It's on the floor." That's where I think he's going to pick it up. I can't. And I felt, just an anger and an irritation. And I sort of, I said, "Well, I'm just going to take the pencil then. You're going to have to use your old crummy pencil." And then I thought,
that's
the whole
too.
Thing. Going
yeah.
And I just walked away.
Yeah.
And I suddenly saw, if this whole show on, I could just not be in the show.
Activated, exactly.
But
you saw it.
And yeah, I saw it. And then colleague and I, we listened to just the guided meditation before. We do it an hour and a half later. It starts by saying, "Notice your body." And I thought, I could still feel the wanting to shout at that kid. Right in there, I was still like, but I thought, no, it's just really this show that goes on.
Yeah, and that's a war. In miniature, right?
Yeah.
That really is. What else is it for it? Or a standoff?
Yeah.
It's right there, right in your face. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Could you say that space is an awareness without ego?
Well, that's interesting. The thing is that space isn't owned by anything. It actually just exists. So your awareness, that's a really interesting, you could say that. And you could also say that who are who's being aware?
Mm-hmm.
So that's also space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Good. But because I raise this only because the word space comes up a lot in our meditation practice. And what are we talking about? And it's that, it's the gap, it's your own awareness of that nothing is solid. It's a whole slew of things. And its characteristics, that's a much larger question. But what are space's characteristics? That's kind of an interesting place. Maybe we'll go there at some point. That's kind of interesting. So, a few of you have read the chapter on auspicious coincidence. This is a point that Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche in this book introduces this subject, and it's the Tibetan word for it is tendril. No need to write it down, it's in the book. And also tashi, which also means blessing. So that's kind of interesting. And the implication is that whatever is happening at the moment is, as Michael said the last class, is fitting, it's good, and it's precisely fitting to the situation. Well, what does that mean? That means that fundamentally everything you've done in your life since being born and everything that occurred throughout your life, every moment has brought you infallibly to this moment. So it's not like a big super surprise that you ended up here. This is a little difficult to digest, perhaps. And I know Roberta has this issue about what do you mean everything's okay?
Yeah, I mean, I liked it when he explained. I read a little bit of the last chapter.
Yeah, good.
And I liked it when he gave the logic, okay, everything you've done has led to this point, and that sounds okay. So...
And
why my life is fucked up.
Well,
but
yeah, but your life also isn't solid. It isn't like, I mean, the point is that this that has brought you to this moment, which is completely open and free, and you have a complete choice as to which direction you move in. So, in fact, that's I was trying to figure out what the hell's so auspicious about this. Pretty much your question. And the auspicious part for me is this sort of sense that there's nothing but this present moment. Nothing. There's not a future. There's just more present moments. You guys have heard this before a million times from a million different sources, I think, I would assume. But without that, it would be as though we were, everything was predestined, and so why bother to do anything? But the truth is that each of us has made choices every step along the way, every step along the way to get to this moment. We've made choices that proved that we liked. We've made choices that fucked us up completely. We've made choices that have led us into dark alleys and really scary situations or brilliant situations. And we've made each and every one of those choices. So it isn't that anybody else made them. You could argue, okay, my mother made me wash my hands, blah, 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 blah. But fundamentally, you know, we don't need to go there. But the point is that in this moment, anything is possible, which is both terrifying and brilliant. So from my perspective, that's where the auspiciousness perhaps comes from. I don't think the Tibetans particularly worry about that. They don't see it. It doesn't appear to me that auspiciousness is an issue, that they're hashing out what do they mean by auspicious, or that maybe the Western interpretation is different from the Tibetan, perhaps the way it is. But so what does that mean? If everything is perfectly and precisely fitting into a situation, because everything is the result of what came before, then there's a direct line between cause and effect. Our past actions bring us to this present moment in which anything can happen. It's not a mystery. It's not incomprehensible. It isn't a mistake. And you can't complain. There's no complaint. Who are you going to complain to?
Yourself.
That's your path. That's the path. And that's kind of a big shift, fundamentally. The Oive is kind of taken out of the situation. Quite a bit. He actually did it on more than one occasion. He actually did use the phrase that you can't, that there's no room for Oive in this one. So through our meditation practice, I'm going back to that, we work with loosening our addiction to our own thoughts. We start experiencing spaciousness. And therefore, at a certain point, we can actually stop causing ourselves so much trouble by not behaving in the ways with which we're all familiar. Grasping, being pissed off, having a fit, rejecting, ignoring. We can actually start shifting our behavior and actually stop loosening the link of causation and eventually enlightenment, which we'll talk about that. We can start cutting away at our own attachment, and we can cut the cycle of the nidanas, which Michael also has also been mentioned before. We won't go into that subject here. Yet another subject which all of us are delighted to have to study again. But it's this is the beginning where we can cut the cause of suffering. Actually, right on the cushion. That's where, and every single one of us can do that. We don't have to wear special clothes or sort of just by doing this meditation practice, we have the capacity to start cutting that. The heaviness of these links in the chain of causation. So, Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche says, no one can save you from the karmic results of your past. But if you appreciate the openness and of the present moment, you can go ahead with confidence and commitment in your present life. And he talks about no one can fix you or save you, which is a really intense thing to hear, to read, I think. And it's very interesting that he says that, because I think we often look to religion is a way that sort of magical things can happen and we can be fixed or we can be remedied. The remedy is in our own awareness, as you said.
In the Temer's book that we read about the Lojong, in the chapter on cases, not expecting fruition, abandon all hope.
Yeah.
She talks about, and that's one that hit me really hard, was like, the idea of fruition is to get somewhere good, because where you are now isn't, and how you are now isn't good.
Right.
And what you have to let go of is that idea and realize that you are good right now. Just how you are. That's so hard.
Even if things don't feel good.
Right.
And he talks further along in this chapter about being willing to make decisions that don't feel so wonderful, but we actually know they're the correct decision. And we're still wanting everything to feel nice, to be tied up with a nice little bow, and everything is okay in the end. And the reality that terrible things happen, we all know that our beautiful lives will come to an end. That's not so great. That's not my favorite thing. But by being present, by being present with whatever happens without complaint, you're able to actually navigate these situations with some kind of dignity and awake. Another thing that was an interesting thing that he said in this chapter is that the future is never prearranged. He said it's vacant. Does that strike anybody in those of you who read the material?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting? Vacant. And that's terrifying, actually. That can be quite terrifying. And we come to see, we come to know ourselves and our tendencies and our habits, and our dirty little secrets that we don't like about ourselves. And we come to appreciate them. He even says, we are each a particular type of person with a particular type of mania, and that is good. So there's permission, actually, not to terrify yourself, but actually to start not just applying the sense of space to externalness, but to also oneself, to one's own conundrum of oneself. That, and also, I wanted to mention here something that wasn't in this chapter, which I touched on slightly in the one before, that when you start a meditation practice, you're actually creating a situation where you're letting all the nasty hidden stuff reveal itself. It isn't like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to feel really good. It's actually all sorts of stuff comes up and you go, who said that? It's me. You know, how you find out things about your own nature or your own garbage even. And that's actually proper. That you, the things, the sort of, there's this another slogan, which is work with the greater dishonor first. So those of you who did the Bojong class, remember that. This practice is actually all about letting you see these greater defilements. They're all workable. None of them, no part of us is unworkable. That's a bloody miracle. No part of us, no and that is for me. He says, this is a much more definite kind of direction than having a map or a blueprint to follow. It is a real direction. Pain will be real pain, and pleasure will be real pleasure. Confusion will be real confusion. Every situation will be a true situation, a precise one. And that is the guidance. That's the pattern you go along with. You can trust this because you're not running and hiding from yourself. You're actually meeting your life head on, moment to moment, without, again, complaint or too much complaint, or you're getting hip to your own fear. And you can cut it, you can stop it as it comes up, because you're training yourself to do that. When you're on the cushion, you're training yourself to do that.
The stillness of the cushion, for me, allows a mindfulness of just how busy I am. So you said, well, what is space? Space is kind of existing without those different layers that are constant. They're constant, but you don't realize how much you're just getting peppered by your own layers. And
that's exactly why we study the skandhas. Because that bubbling of subconscious gossip and in this chapter, actually, Chögyam Trungpa refers to this and says, that's not a problem. It's not your enemy. You don't have to shut that down. You just don't have to act on it. So it's not like, I wish
you
I didn't think.
It.
I'm beg your pardon?
You see through it.
Again and again and again. Yeah. So that's why we slog through the skandhas, actually. Precisely because of that. Yeah. This is when your life actually starts to become a path. Where they talk about what the dharmic path. This is when your life starts actually becoming workable. You start waking up to your own patterns, but you're applying it with the basis of your meditation practice. This isn't therapy, although they have to marry in some spots. But you actually, your own awareness of your own patterns starts and becoming a path, becoming your friend. And things that occur, you're present for whatever, for what arrives in your life. And you can relate to what arises, and it arises in your life with spaciousness and clarity, and make a decision to take a right turn or a left turn. That point.
So you're in the driver's seat. Instead of being in the back seat.
Yeah, you're not in the back
around,
seat.
You're in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
And you can chart your own course.
But you do anyway. You do it. Yeah.
No, but I'm just saying that a lot of times we aren't in the driver's
Why
seat.
Why did this happen to me?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that this discursive thought is so constant that we don't even know unless we sit through them. That's why, if theoretically the five skandhas are so useful to actually experience them is a different story. But I mean, when you do sit, you do. I do realize just how difficult it is to stay in that out breath, in that gap, in that space, without any noise, any static.
But I think the thing is that the static is going to come up. The static isn't the problem. You don't make the static a problem. It's not a problem. It occurs, blah, 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 blah. And so there's no
problem. I'm just learning that, and he expresses that, and the thinking isn't, they're not intruders. They're really teachers, and it's part of transcending this whole process, to just accept it and know that it is there.
There's a great expression, becoming friends with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Which includes all your little dark little corners and all your discursiveness. None of it's a problem. Being led around by it. But that's why we're practicing, not to be led around by it. And he says, looking back, we find that all the situations in which we have had a sense of making a journey were situations of living constantly in the present moment. There was no sense of predestination involved at all. The present situation is the destination as well as the path. So it's a genuine relationship with ourselves and the world at this moment. And so this kind of, what we were talking about before, this sense of anxiety about, should I do this or should I do that? There's actually, if we've created enough space, we actually know.
He does a great job of summing that up when he talks about, when the question was, when conflict arises, I usually feel I have no control in the situation. I feel that I can make a choice, but now I am wondering whether I am actually making the correct choice. And Rinpoche responds that there's nothing the matter with the idea of choice. In dealing with situation, the choice is already there. Choice consists of two aspects of the situation which are happening at the same time. Those two aspects provide a basis for your making a relationship with either of the alternatives. The way to work with that is in making that choice, not going according to your sense of comfort, mm-hmm. but go according to straightforwardness.
And this, interestingly, you point this out.
Yeah, well, what's really neat is he even brings this in. So I'm reading a lot about
the Bardo, exactly.
And he goes on down to talk about the Tibetan mm-hmm. Book of the Dead. And he talks about how, and this is in two other texts that I'm reading about the Bardo, that you will see a bright light, but that bright light is so brilliant and pure that it's painful. You'll also see a less bright light mm-hmm. that's not as uncomfortable. You'll be drawn to that light because you can't handle the purity and the beauty of that bright light. That's
but
there.
He says it's not. He says it's irritating.
Sure,
I mean, it may not be beautiful.
The truth is
actually
the truth is very painful, actually. But the point is, you're training yourself to let go of what's comfortable, and to go with what's true, what's the truth. And I like how his point is, it's going to become apparent when you let go of what's comfortable and what's not comfortable.
Yeah.
Let go of the judgment, and the answer will come up to you,
and
it's there. You still won't want to take it, perhaps, but you'll see it, and that's particularly important in the Bardo because. Those decisions impact your rebirth.
That's right.
It's all just projection.
So, thank you. That's actually, I was going to.
I'm glad I skipped ahead.
No, I'm really glad. No. it's like you just said, thank you.
And thank you, Michael Sagan, for telling me to go back. So last week I hadn't read the chapter in consciousness. I went back and read it.
Yeah.
And I see what you mean. It's like if you want to understand the bardo, you got to get back into this. And I did. So I finished both texts.
Good. So I would really recommend y'all read this chapter. It's actually this chapter and the next. So there's a shift in the way this material is presented. So it's not, and in fact, if you'd indulge me, I wanted to read something that the Vidyatara says in the last chapter. He says about this material, the idea is to feel, this is page 96 in our book, the idea is to try to feel the general outline of the whole thing rather than being too faithful to every sentence and every word. If we really get ourselves in a twist with this material, what is he talking about? And that can be really frustrating. And all of a sudden, I was reading this thinking, why didn't he put this at the beginning of the book? You know? That would have been a great relief to get this information, because it says if you get too involved with it, he said getting, rather than being too faithful to every sentence, that kind of attitude has become a big problem in the study of Buddhism.
Actually, he said something very comparable that I could relate to earlier, too. He said to focus on experiencing versus learning. And he gave the example of people who took a vow to be bodhicitta.
Yeah.
That, you know, they vow not to get enlightened. And then ultimately what ends up happening, they're the embodiment of the Dharma. And they end up getting enlightened because they're experiencing it.
But the vow is not to leave this cycle of life and death, of birth and death. They vow to stay.
Mm. Right, but the example that he gives, I mean, it's so clear. He's saying, don't think about learning, think about being in it, and you relax into it.
Yeah, this isn't a test. There's nobody grading this. You know, this is your path. And that's kind of awesome and lonely, and that's why Sangha, having us all together, we're an enormous resource for each other. That we're willing to do this together, that we're willing to go through this material together, talk about our personal experiences.
I was going to say the succession too that we've kind of gone through. It kind of makes sense. You can connect the dots, because especially because it's so out there from the ordinary existence. And remember when we started with the cliches, and it just kind of makes sense.
Can I make
advertisement?
Yeah. please use us. We're here to help as your meditation instructors, to be a benefit to you in any way we can. And sometimes you have issues that you don't know how to relate with, or you just want to talk about. That's our offering to you, is to be able to be here and meet with you in any way you wish. I know some of you have meditation instructors and some of you don't. Part of the problem with there's the three jewels, I'm sure you've heard. There's the Buddha, which are the teachers, are the enlightened beings the humans who have attained enlightenment, beings who have attained enlightenment. Not necessarily human. There's the Dharma, which are the teachings, and there's the Sangha. These are the three jewels, and they need each other in order for the to have a they benefit each other. They lean on one another to become awake for the path. We need each other as sangha.
So it's like a tripod.
Exactly. That's good.
Mr. Cameraman.
Oh, oh. Are you a photographer or are you a chauffeur?
That's good. So this is the three jewels. You are the jewels for each other. We're the jewels for each other. And so that's my pitch. That's what I was going to say.
Your pitch.
Yes. And also make a continue your commitment to sitting on a regular basis, even for the littlest period of time, because things shift and you're not even aware that they're shifting until you actually notice a change in your own approach. So those are my pitches. I think there was one other thing I wanted to read about auspicious coincidence, which is, and then we can have further questions if you want. So this is, and remember we're talking about how events are interconnected and this present moment is contingent upon the previous moment on through history. So this is something I found in Harper's in January. Actually, this Harper's January 2016. It's from queries submitted by telephone and in person to the New York Public Library's Reference and Research Services between 1940 and 1989. And one of the ones that they were all fabulous, as you can imagine. But the one that really got me, and I think is appropriate for this, is here's a question. Do you have a list of historical characters who were in the right place at the right time?
Sounds like a New Yorker
question. Yeah. It actually could be a New Yorker question. Yeah. So are there any further questions? Hello.
So would Trojan Trumpet say everyone? Everyone is in the right place.
Exactly.
There you go.
That's
at every moment.
That's right. Yeah.
Interesting idea of understanding he used that term of imperfect, in terms of just sense of perfect. And not because it feels good or everything explains everything. It's more about just exactly where it is and the fundamental rightness of understanding what is actually going on, which is really interesting.
I mean, and Roberta raised, I mean, the issue that you raised has been one of mine too. I mean, how does something like the Holocaust happen? What's so good about that? What's so right about that? Mm. I mean, it's a hard concept to wrap your mind around, that bad things happen. How can that be good? And I don't profess to have a response.
I don't think it's good or bad. It's just cause and effect. I mean, the collective ignorance that just boiled to that mentality or that, you know, mind stream. I think it's bad, but I mean,
I know.
It's just the causation.
It's a conundrum. You're right, and it still remains even for me a conundrum. I mean. Then you hear something like the terrible things that happened to Tibetans when Tibet was invaded and all the monasteries destroyed and thousands of monks murdered and so on and so forth. But Rinpoche has said that actually released the Dharma to the West. Mm-hmm. And none of us would be sitting here if that hadn't happened. So, and then I, even on a personal level, my son is in grad school in Boston. Oh, we're so excited he's in grad school in Boston. He's here. He'll be near us. Well, it turns out he has an advisor who's a real pill. And so here's this wonderful situation, and yet he's stuck in a really difficult situation. So is it good or bad? Well, I don't know, but maybe he's met some interesting people there that will lead to an interesting future. Maybe that's good. But maybe he'll meet some really crazy broad. Maybe that's bad. You know what I mean? So it kind of goes on and on and on like this.
Mother's nearby. Jewish mother's nearby.
So that really, it's a conundrum.
I think about the homeless people I work with that are alcoholics and drug addicts, that I was sitting at the least not yelling at the guy with the pencil, and I brought someone to his appointment with a podiatrist this morning because he broke his foot, he's been a few times, and he, you know, was going on about how the Bristol Lodge isn't doing what they're supposed to for him. Mm-hmm. And the doctor isn't doing what, you know, she's supposed to for him. His primary care, well, they should be calling him. And I'm like, I just totally took the bait and fought with him, you know, because I was like ripping at this guy who was blaming the world for all of his stuff. Well, they should be proactive. And I, you know, ended up saying the person who needs to be proactive is you. But it's just what everybody owes me. It's a lot of, I'm not getting, you know, I remember being there one time and this woman, you know, we were just getting through serving lunch, sort of. She, well, I'm not going to come here anymore if I don't get better services. I'm not getting this. I said, no, I'm a volunteer. And I said, well, right now you have lunch. So maybe after we serve lunch, we can talk about. But it's really to see any good in it. And, you know, I see where everything they've done up to this point leads them to where they are. But they're in really
and leads you
places.
To that, them to you in this moment, actually, mm-hmm. which is really interesting. And you're, that's really interesting.
So instructor
thinks
I should
be in
our class.
It's
your path.
The idea is not to get caught up and hooked by your own labels.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just saying something's good or bad.
Yeah.
You're hooking yourself with your labels. And you need to go forward with your love and compassion, with, I guess they call it equanimity, with just, it is what it is. But what good are you if you're going to get hooked up in your good and bad judgment of ways?
For yourself and for.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I think this is the word that just keeps coming to me is acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And where we begin with acceptance is on the cushion. And we have some, if we have some idea, you know, thoughts are bad, let's, every thought comes up, whack,
mm-hmm.
whack. We're going to hit every thought.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't really leading to any kind of compassion for oneself. And that's the training ground for having compassion with other people,
mm-hmm.
that sense of acceptance. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean you don't see things as good or bad. I mean, they're, you know, difficult situations. But there's also more space in there for just acceptance of things and working with what is rather than going at it with aggression or trying to make something different because you think it should be different. Who knows?
My sense is that the space is, I mean, it's probably what everyone's saying, but I just, that I think the acceptance doesn't mean that you accept that what's happening is happening, which then I think frees you to act, which means
mm-hmm.
that you're not going to accept in a different way of using the word accept the Holocaust. If you were there and you had a chance to kill somebody to defend someone else,
exactly.
But it's just that you're not getting wrapped up like inefficiently, so you can act more efficiently.
Precision
for the
and awareness.
If you've been a parent of a teenager, you get hooked very easily. I had just finished reading an article about this that said a lot of times when, so your teenager comes home and says two approaches, I flunked my test, I need some Ben and Jerry's to help get over it. And that's the passion from the parent. Or I flunked my test and just goes and starts to play video games and it's like, you know, no worries. And both of those can hook us. The other one can hook us, making us feel like they don't care about the situation. And it talks about how they could have offloaded their feelings earlier on in school, and now they come back. Or they can come and offload their feelings to you, and that's what they need to do to be able to act. And the key thing is to not get hooked on whatever their approach is. And just, I had this situation with my youngest, who was deferred from MIT, so she's not going to find out if she's accepted to MIT for a couple more months. Mm-hmm. And she's stressing now. And so I want to jump in as mom and fix it, you know, and I like, so what does that mean? You know, and I just let her talk it out. And I didn't do anything. I didn't give her any solutions. I didn't act or anything. And at the end, she said, thanks for listening. And she went up to do her homework. Mm-hmm. And that's all she needed was just to put that out there and be heard. Mm-hmm. And have somebody not try to fix it, not try to, you know, because I knew that whatever suggestion I would give would be the wrong solution, you know.
Because they couldn't come from you.
That's right. So I just kept asking her questions about how she felt about it and just was there to listen, and it worked perfectly. I'm like, I wish she had known this a while ago.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's
good.
So that not getting hooked works.
Did the guy with the pencil end up picking it up because you left? Did you know
no,
what happened?
No, he didn't. No, it really, he, you know, and at the end, it's interesting, I just, at the end of class, there was a teacher who helped out with me, and I said, you know, when you did that, it started to make me mad. Hmm. And so, you know, and I wonder if you wanted that to happen.
Yeah.
Like, is that what you were trying to do? Mm-hmm. And he said, no, I wasn't really, which, you know, I don't know if it was or wasn't. But I could just look at it and say, uh-huh. It was so like, you know, like I think all of you could imagine it. You know, like the teacher in the room, and mm-hmm. the kid does something, say, can you pick that up? You know, no. I just can't.
Whoa.
I just can't. You know, like, I think he could. No, he didn't. And, you know, he's a kid who has all kinds of stuff going on. It's a class of kids who are English language learners who come to the United States as teenagers.
Wow.
And often coming from having not lived with a parent who's been here, and then they come live with this adult that I don't really know. Mm-hmm. And if you think dealing with a teenager who's grown up with you is hard.
Yes. No, I love that. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, who knows? But no, he's been.
He's testing you.
I don't know what he's doing. I don't really know what he's doing. I know how it felt. That's why I shared with him is it felt like I started to get angry, and I wondered if that's what you wanted to happen.
Does it change it if he's touching you?
What's that?
Does it change your reaction if he's touching you?
Probably not. Yeah. Good point.
Well, what I'm appreciative of is that it sounded to me like you were able to, you know, keep it on your side of the street, so to speak, but then also lovingly say, this is what I experienced when you did that,
mm-hmm.
you know, without any kind of attachment. It didn't sound, anyway, any attachment to the outcome, which I think is like, that's like you're keeping it on your side of the street, but you're also like, especially when you're dealing with young people, I think it's important to kind of let them know how their actions affect others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had another interaction with them today that we have the student teachers who worked with us tomorrow's her last day. So she's only there every other day. So today we were writing her chorus. And she has spent so much time working with this young man. He clearly likes him an awful lot. Could you write her card, Norman? Draw a picture. You know. And I was like, well, you know, I tried all the different controlling strategies. And then, it, you know, at some point he said, I don't say goodbye to people.
Mm.
He said, I didn't even say goodbye to him. And
wow.
He said, I'm not going to tell you.
Wow.
His mother's still in Brazil.
Mm.
Yeah. So,
So this is so beautiful because the thing is, we're sitting there with all of our projections and reactions to this challenge. And there's this whole universe that we don't know anything about. And as Emily said, it's just compassion is the key, and our tendency is to use a hammer.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Now if I tell him tomorrow we talk to all of
them. Don't say a word.
Not a good idea.
No.
Yeah, he might like it. Well, you know what's funny? He probably would like it, but he would never say it.
Yeah. But could you actually explain this class?
I just say remember when I...
Yeah. Wonderful. We're cooked.
So I just want to make an announcement. As you know, we won't be meeting for the next 2 weeks, holidays, and a week we'll send out something about possible meditation or something that will be done. And we'll be, today is the end of this module, module 10. So we'll begin in January, I think it's January 7th when we come back. I think what we're going to do is maybe two classes on chant. People have been asking about that, and we'll present some material on Buddhist chants. We haven't done a lot of that here, but since people really have been wanting that, we'll explain some opening and closing chants. And then we'll start a new module after that. We'll be, we have an idea what we're going to do, but we aren't totally sure, so I won't say. But it'll be posted online, so and that way you can get whatever book you need.
Do people know that if you go to the website, what's the top tab called?
Education.
Education. Go down to chants and songs, and then look at Waltham Buddhist Meditation Chant Book. And up comes a PDF with all the chants, some of which you may not have seen, and you might enjoy them. I told this to one person here who had never heard one of them, and she said, oh, I mean you can do that too? Okay.
Right.
Are we done?
I just want to thank you all for letting us join you.
Thank you
for being here. Very engaging to hear the discussion.
I had first-hand experience being at Open Medicine, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful location, really wonderful people, and it's on Sundays.
Right. Because people have been asking for more places to meditate and more times to come together to meditate with other people. So I think this center is really excellent. So it's in Lexington, easy to get to from here. So it's on our, I think Michael put a link to it on our website.
Yeah, it's under resources tab, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you can click on that and you'll find out more about the schedule and how to get there.